You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Today, we're in Chamrousse.
Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freib.
Hello, chaps.
And this is a bit of a different podcast today. This is an As Live Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. The stage isn't finished yet. We are on our way to the summit of Chamrousse, first day in the Alps. And we're going to sort of bring you dispatches as the stage unfolds and then come back at the finish. So they're about to start the final climb. Already a difficult day for Vincenzo Nibali with his teammate Michele Scarponi being dropped on the first climb, and Jakob Fuglsang crashing quite heavily on the descent. And you see another of these kind of inexplicable crashes. He came down very hard indeed, but was up quite quickly, washing his wounds with his bidon and carrying on. Not sure he'll get back for the climb, but you know, those are two very, very strong teammates in the mountains, especially, aren't they, Lionel?
They are probably the two strongest teammates in the mountains. I'm not sure, I haven't really seen yet where Scarponi's been riding on the climbs. Today we would have seen, I would have suspected he'd be second last man or last man, and Fuglsang would be the other one that would do the final pulls for Nibali. So it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out. Daniel made the point on Twitter about the climb of Chamrousse being quite sparsely populated compared to Alpe d'Huez, which is not that far away. But I thought as we drove up, it's a long way, isn't it? 18 kilometres. And it does feel noticeably longer than Alpe d'Huez, and it is steep in places.
Yes, it is. Now, we're in the car now, in Team Jaguar. That was the door closing there. And we're about to drive up. I'm not sure if I should... I don't know what the rules are about podcasting and driving, so perhaps hand over to Daniel.
Well, I'm already alarmed because we're going to be coming up against the publicity caravan, which is just coming through the finish.
Lionel hasn't put his seatbelt on.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib.
So, Daniel, how do you think the climb will play out? We've seen Francaise Desjeux coming towards the front. They've obviously got Thibaut Pinot highly placed overall. How do you see it playing out?
Well, I see Pinot as one of the favourites today. It's a climb that he likes. It's quite steady, long. And something, I think, which may be greatly to his advantage over the next week or so is the absence of Froome and Contador, not just in the way that they'll alter the race, but I spoke to him a few weeks ago about, you know, his future ambitions and where he saw himself in relation to those guys, and he sort of admitted that he was quite intimidated by them and he didn't really feel that he could ever attain the same level as them, and he felt that they dealt better with stress, etc., and he was almost in awe of them. And with those two now gone, I really feel that he's lost any kind of inferiority complex that he had. And, you know, you can almost see his chest is puffed out, and he seems a different animal, really. So I expect him to go well today. This is the publicity caravan.
Yeah, the publicity caravan boys and girls are D-Mob happy there. They've probably spent 5 hours out on their various vehicles, waving at the public, throwing things out, and they've crossed the finish line, and probably time for them to hit the bar, I would have thought.
That's a dangerous assumption, Lionel. Just on the subject of the French again, L'Equipe once again today going big on the you know, the sort of French Renaissance. It was Pinot and Romain Bardet on the front page of L'Equipe today, and not a huge crowd on the climb, but a lot of French flags, I think, we spotted, and you know, perhaps there is a sort of resurgence of interest in the Tour in France. Is that your impression as well, Daniel?
No, it wasn't actually. I mentioned this to Sam Dancy, my travelling companion, that I didn't really feel that it had any impact just yet.
What about the French having several riders up there overall? Does that embolden them in a way, because there isn't just one rider shouldering the hopes of a nation?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I talked about a complex there, and this is something that they've had for many, many years. It's a sort of hangover from the post-Festina era when they didn't feel they could compete, and the French themselves constantly talking about their riders being decomplexed, literally. So having that kind of sense of inferiority just gradually kind of eroded, and now they really do feel as though they're on an even footing and they can compete with anyone. As regards, I mean, the individuals themselves, Perrault is not, so that's the second AG2R Le Mondial rider, 37-year-old former mountain biker. He's not the most aggressive rider, and he will probably try to hang on as long as possible. Bardet, on the other hand, is young and sort of quite impetuous at times, very aggressive, and I think we could well see him attack today. But he will probably be the one French rider who's willing to risk everything over the next few days.
Well, we better park up, Richard, because we've just seen the shuttle bus going up to the finish line there.
So we're now trekking up the hill. We've abandoned the Jaguar and we're trekking up the hill to the finish. Still quite a bit of the stage to go. I think they're about to start the climb. We were at the start this morning in Saint-Étienne, speaking to various riders. I spoke to Michał Kwiatkowski, the Polish rider we've been speaking about a lot on the podcast. I had a chat with Michał, very nice chap. I should explain, I asked him at one point about his academy, which he established over the winter. He's a very young rider, but he established an academy for young riders modelled on a sports school that he attended himself as a teenager. And this academy is for kids from age 9 to 19. And he's now got 120 kids in the academy. It's a full-time sort of sports school model with coaches employed. And it's a residential as well for kids who've come from outside his hometown of Tarn. So anyway, here is Michał Kwiatkowski. Almost 2 weeks into the tour now, you're well placed overall. You've also been aggressive on some stages. What's the ambition for you here, to finish high overall or to perhaps try and win a stage?
Actually, no, not at all. Not one of them. You know, I think this tour is my second Tour de France, and the most important thing is exploring myself, and I don't know how I'm going to end up. And for the moment, everything going well. You know, we won two stages even without calf, and that's amazing. And I was trying, I was always close, but you know, a bit of luck and could be better. But yeah, I never give up, and I will try to stay with the best riders in the upcoming stages.
So primarily it's a learning experience, is it, for you?
Yeah, of course, you know, it's a thing. You really have to know your limits on the Grand Tour. You know, I still know that I could prepare better for the Tour, you know, but you know, my ambitions are high for every other race. So yeah, of course, Tour de France is the biggest race of the year, and I want to show myself, especially here. But you know, it's not like that Tour de France and nothing else. So
how is your form? Because you've been winning since February, right at the start of the season. You've been in great form all year. Strade Bianche was a terrific race for you as well. How do you feel your form is now? Have you managed to maintain that since that sort of flying start you had?
I think it doesn't feel like I was in the first part of the season. You know, I had not such a big, you know, break between Romandy and Dauphiné, and I lose my confidence actually on Dauphiné. I was not sure what's going on, and I was back in form for national championship, and then I was not actually sure about my form for the Tour. But the first week showed that I'm on the good way, but maybe not for the high climbs, but still I could do something here, so that's important, you know. And yeah, we'll see.
What was it like the other day riding behind Tony Martin for so long? What's he like as a teammate?
Yeah, he's incredible. He's you know, what he gives to the team is just you cannot really describe, you know, because he's a great champion, but he bring a lot to the team, you know. He always, because of him, there's a great team spirit. And even I was really motivated for the taking the yellow on that day and winning the stage just because of Tony Martin, because he pulled the whole day, and even after the stage when he was alone and taking the win and stage before.
And are you running your national tour of Poland this year after the tour?
and my national.
The Tour of Poland. Are you riding the Tour of Poland this year?
Yeah, I would like to, because the second stage starting from my town, and that's a good opportunity to show, supporters from Poland. And actually the first four stages are flat, then we have two hilly stages and then time trial, so would be nice to be there, but I'm just focused now on the tour, and I want to see how I end up the tour.
And quickly, how's the academy going back in Thorn?
It's going good. I think we have for the moment 120 riders.
Wow.
And that's amazing, and we're working on that, and I think I will meet them after the tour, and they went to actually training camp during the Tour de France in somewhere in Poland, and they were watching me on the tour, so I hope I was great inspiration for them, and I was trying to do my best.
What's the age range there? What ages are they?
From 8 till junior, so until 19 years old, but
finally, Michal, we've been talking about you a lot on our podcast, and a few people in Poland have been pulling us up for our pronunciation. Can you pronounce your full name for us, please?
Yeah, Michal Kwiatkowski.
And one more time?
Michal Kwiatkowski.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So that was Michal Kwiatkowski. I spoke to Simon Clark of Orica Green Edge. He was in the long break on whatever day it is, today,
Thursday.
The previous day, Thursday, that's right. He was away with Sebastian Langeveldt of the Garmin Sharp team for a while. Then he was with Cyril Gaultier of Europcar. And I asked him about the art of getting into breakaways on these kind of hilly stages in the Tour, and also the mountain stages in the Tour, where Simon Clark is sort of expected to get up the road, and if he gets lucky, he might be still in a position to contest a finish on a day like today. It's actually his birthday today, I think his 28th birthday. I actually didn't find that out until after I'd spoken to him, which is why I didn't wish him happy birthday in this little chat. Simon, can you talk us through your day yesterday out on the Escape? How did it go?
Pretty well, I suppose you could say. One of my main jobs here, the reason I'm selected for the Tour de France is to be in breakaways and try and win from the breakaway. So that being my job, I had the best go at trying to succeed yesterday, and unfortunately we just came up short, but I think it was a good opportunity and a good stage to really put on the line and try and pull it off.
Can you talk us through how hard it is to actually get in that breakaway? Because people turn on the television to watch the last hour or the last couple of hours and they see the break established, but for you guys, it's a lot harder than just riding up the road, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And often we can attack for, 50 plus kilometres trying to get in the breakaway. Yesterday, you could say I probably fluked it in that I only did one attack and got straight into it on the first go. So that doesn't happen very often. And I thought, well, if that's it, maybe things could be going my way that day, and it nearly did, but it can be a very challenging task. Circling a day and wanting to get in the breaks one thing, but actually getting in it is another. So I was happy to be able to, it was a team plan to get in the break, and it's always a bit of a stressful exercise getting in there, because if you don't, then it doesn't reflect so well on the team plan, so it was good to be present.
Are there sometimes recriminations if you're planning to get in the break and then it doesn't work out?
Oh, I think we saw that from Europcar yesterday. I'm sure they wanted to be in the breakaway, and unfortunately they missed it. And if you do miss the break, you end up chasing the break. And we saw that happen yesterday, and they tried their move in the final yesterday, and neither of them worked. So you can only try and hope for the best.
So you guys that get in the breaks, you're almost like a subcategory in the Tour itself. When you get up there, up the road, do you look around? Are there certain guys you look at and you think, oh, I'm glad he's with us, because it's going to give you more opportunity to gain more time? I mean, it struck me that Langeveld, you couldn't really have asked for a better guy to be with in that kind of move towards the end.
Oh, definitely. You look, especially with both Gregory Rast and Langeveld, I was really happy that those guys are in there. And you can never choose who you get in the break with. So to just happen to be in the break with those two guys, it couldn't have been a better situation, and that really gave me a lot of confidence with our breakaway potential to succeed because of the experience we had there. And I think with Gregory and Sebastian, you know, working together, and we had a little bit of a plan and how we were going to ride, how hard we were going to ride in particular parts of the day, and I think by sticking to that, we came pretty close to pulling it off.
Last couple then. When you're in that break, do you have much conversation with the other guys, or is it an unspoken thing? Because we see on the graphics sometimes the percentage of who's doing most of the work.
Yeah.
Do you kind of have an agreement, I'll work on the climb, somebody else maybe work on the flat, somebody else take it perhaps on the descent, just to share the workload up to a certain point, and then it's everyone's takes their own chance?
Not necessarily in terms of workload, but we do discuss the pace that we're going to go in particular parts of the stage. So initially you push a bit harder to get an initial time, and then you back off, and for a period there you're just at the mercy of how far the peloton is willing to let you go. And then you wait and pick a part in the race where you're just going to go for it to the line. So not so much about particular riders doing certain extra efforts and others not, but more about everyone riding evenly at an agreed pace and varying that pace depending on the part of the stage.
And the last one then. Looking at the road book, it's a pretty daunting run from here to Paris. I mean, every day, I know the stage to Nîmes is flat, so that doesn't offer much for the breakaway riders like yourself, but every day is daunting. So, I mean, do you just pick a particular day that you're going to target again, or will you just keep going every day, or how are you looking at the last 9 or 10 days?
Look, there's so many factors that come into it, you know. I think that if you just need to take it on a day-by-day basis. You would never have, a couple of days ago, you would never have picked Giant to maybe ride on a day like yesterday. But after John Degenkolb had such a good result in second the day before, they had a lot of confidence in him to perform again yesterday, and they were willing to commit. And I was pretty aware that that was going to happen. But with the heat and, you know, there's so many different factors, you just need to make an assessment of the days, up and coming days, and pick the day that you think's the best chance for the breakaway to stay.
So that was Simon Clark of Orica Green Edge. Daniel, you spoke to a couple of people this morning.
Very quick fire this, isn't it? We're going from one to another.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Recapping on the morning, and then we'll...
You got anything to add? Apart from that, Daniel, before we go into your eclipse?
Happy birthday, Simon Clark, if you're listening.
He's bound to be.
Who else? Who did I speak to? I had quite a long conversation with Johnny Schleck. Unfortunately, it was in French, so no good for the podcast.
That's Andy and Frank's father.
Who was talking to me about how impossible it is for Andy and Frank now, the scrutiny they face from the tabloid press in Luxembourg, how he told them years ago that they needed to move to Monaco, but they didn't want to give up their fishing in Luxembourg. Actually, on the subject of fishing, we mentioned Thibaut Pinot. I know I mention him every day. Multiple times, but we're coming into the Alps, and he's one of the few riders who's never done any altitude training in this Tour de France, or certainly contenders for the general classification in the Tour de France. One reason is he loves his fishing too much. He doesn't want to go away and not be able to fish for more than 10 days or 2 weeks at a time.
Fish don't like altitude either, do they?
is there nowhere with a lake with freshwater fishing?
He, like the Schlecks, he also has his own pond.
Right.
So,
well, if we're just walking past Greg LeMond's car, he's a big fisherman as well.
Anyway, on to much more serious matters. Obviously, yesterday there was the tragic event, the plane crash in Ukraine. And there is only one Ukrainian rider in the field. That is Andrei Grivko, the Astana rider. And I spoke to him this morning about what had happened yesterday and, you know, how much of a distraction that was for him. You spoke to your family and checked they're okay? And...
Yeah, for sure it is a big tragedy for, I think, for all world, because in this ship it was people from Europe, from Australia, from a lot of country. And I think it's a big message for this whole country like Europe, for and the really this aggressive Russian politic, and try to do something really serious, and not more war from Russia with Ukraine. It's, now it's also a problem for international people.
Has it been on your mind a lot in the last couple of months when you've been racing, the situation back home?
My situation is just like was before. We have last 6 months. It was always it was normally it was work because every day died some person, died some people in Ukraine from terrorists, and this is big problem. But alone for Ukraine is very difficult because Russia have big power. Also, politically, we need the help from Europe and America, you know, from all...
And specifically from where you're from, your region, how is the situation there?
There is, like, more easy because I was from Ukraine, from Crimea, and Crimea more easy because people just live alone. Ukrainian military just go away from there because there is was... A lot of Russian military and don't do the war like in Donetsk. But people live, but all Crimea wish turn back and with Ukraine. But people not wish dying, don't wish war, and just waiting maybe of very big pressure for do some politically for turn back with Ukraine.
So we're nearing the top of the climb here at Chamrouze. We're about to head up some steps to the team buses, which are parked just beyond the finish line. There's the familiar mountain smells at the Tour de France of burning clutch.
Yeah. This looks like a steep hike, Richard. We've got to yomp up some
grassy
hillside.
And not a sound out of breath, shall we? Daniel's bounding ahead. Not sure what he's trying to prove. He's a little bit younger than us, but who's that breathing heavily? Is that you or me, Lionel? Sounds like you.
Yeah.
Come on. We
can come on.
Oh, where's my inhaler?
For a moment, that was alarming. Very alarming. Right, we've reached the top of the steep hill. We're in the compound where the team buses
There's Gregor
are.
Brown.
There is Gregor Brown, all the journalists making their way snooping to the finish area.
Gilles Simon from L'Equipe. What a fortuitous meeting, eh, Gilles, because we are recording for our podcast here. L'Equipe have been getting very excited this week about the French riders. How do you feel this is a big weekend for them?
A little bit too much exciting.
Gilles is the head of cycling at L'Equipe. But you clearly feel that this is a big opportunity for them with some of the favourites out of the field.
It's a big opportunity, but they're still young, and it's a little bit early for them. Maybe one of the both young riders, Bardet or Pinot, can do something important. Maybe a third or fourth place. But they will have to
win the race. Maybe a bit too soon, is it?
Yes, obviously too soon.
Yeah.
Obviously too soon.
How big would it be in France? We compare it often to Wimbledon, and British tennis players for years didn't get very far in Wimbledon. How big would it be in France for one of these riders to finish on the podium?
It would be great because we're waiting for 29 years for a French winner. But it can also be a danger for them. They are very young. Perrault can finish on the podium and it will be safe for him.
Mm.
But for Pinot and Bardet, maybe it can be dangerous. Pinot can win the Tour. I'm convinced of that. But not yet. Maybe in 3, 4, 5, 6 years.
Mm.
2 years ago, he finished at the 10th place. And he has paid it at a high price a year later.
Mm.
I don't want him to pay again next year if he climbs on the podium.
Yeah, so today. Better gradual progression.
Maybe the best for him will be a fourth or fifth place with a white jersey.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Gilles. I'll let you get to the finish. Thank you very much.
We better catch up with Daniel, Richard. He's gone heading off. He's watching the big screen that's on the side of the Garmin Sharp bus. Very considerate of them. They wheel the awning out.
They do.
Roll the awning out for us so we can stand
Garmin
in the
Sharp
shade.
Always a very accessible, open, friendly team, aren't they? And there it is on the side.
Port's been popped. Port's out of the back.
Richie Porte is off the bike already, right at the start of the
climb. There goes Pino attacking.
Goodness, well, we weren't really expecting that.
The moment of Pino attacking, I thought you sounded a bit more excited than that. I think he's ecstatic and so he's just trying to be cool.
We should probably mention just what Grivko said there, Ukrainian rider. He talked quite interestingly. I know his English wasn't particularly great in that clip, but he speaks much better Italian, I must say. He spoke about how, as far as he's concerned, everyone in Crimea, which is where he's from, feels very much Ukrainian and can't wait for Russia to sort of be forced out, but which I was, you know, kind of quite surprised by. But
there's so much uncertainty in that country at the moment. Where is he based? Do you know where he's based?
Crimea. Oh, he's based, I think, in Italy.
But presumably family and friends are all there. It must be a really terrible thing to be living through at the moment. And perhaps we don't, I mean, this is not really a subject for a cycling podcast, but
it's, you know, what new ground for the cycling podcast.
But what happened yesterday, I think, brought into sharp focus just how dire and how awful the situation is there. And, you know, did you feel that he, this is something he's been living with for weeks and months now?
Yeah, that's what he said. You know, yesterday was really just more of the same. It was just an escalation. And yesterday it was obviously predominantly tourists that were killed, or all tourists that were killed. And he was sort of more, well, dismayed by what's been happening over the last 6 months, you know, the sort of ongoing civil war that's been happening there.
So we're watching it now outside the Garmin Sharp bus, about 7.5 kilometres of the climb to go, and a group of four has been established at the front. Vincenzo Nibali, Alejandro Valverde, who started the attack, Thibaut Pinot, who's been doing an awful lot of work, and Laurens ten Dam, who's sort of just hanging on to that group. And behind, TJ van Garderen and Romain Bardet seem to be leading the chase, but they've fallen a minute behind. And looking at that front group, I mean, we...
Well, let's not forget that Rafał Majka and Leopold Koenig are up ahead group of favourites.
Let's not forget that. Apologies, I forgot about those two. They're up ahead. But that group behind could be certainly looks like it might be the podium at the end of the day. It could be the podium in Paris, Nibali, Valverde and Pino. Is that premature?
A little bit premature, I would say. Pino's very inexperienced. Valverde, well, we've seen Richie Porte already have a bad day. That's always been his Achilles heel in major tours. Valverde has the same problem to a certain extent, less so in the Vuelta in previous years, but certainly in the Tour de France. But they're certainly putting a good amount of time between themselves and this group that we're just watching now, headed by Romain Bardet with Jürgen van den Broek on his wheel.
Bardet looks good, though. He looks like he's still got a lot of riding in him. But you wonder, with these efforts he's making now, what, you know, why he wasn't able to follow the initial move.
I mean, the guys in front look like they've got another gear, don't they? They look like they almost look like they're literally using different gears. They're much more powerful.
Here goes Nibali.
An attack by Nibali. This is going to test Pino, because he was riding at the front. I know, Daniel, you made the point when we were just talking before we started recording again, that riding on the front in the mountains doesn't sap the energy quite as much as riding on the front. The difference between sitting in the wheels is not as significant going uphill, but it's still a little factor. And as we're seeing now, Nibali's pulled out quite a gap there. And by showing his hand there, Pino, Valverde can quite legitimately look at him and say, well, you were setting the pace a minute ago, you close that gap.
Yeah, and I think the drafting factor probably is quite significant on a climb like this. Okay, it is fairly shaded, but also the road is also very wide, so you know, there will be some exposure to the wind on there, won't there?
Yeah, this reminds me a bit of Chris Froome on Mont Ventoux last year, you know, in the yellow jersey, going quite far from the top. You know, still a fair old distance to go, and Nibali's riding straight up to the leading pair, Koenig and Majka, and yeah, he's. I think Pino has made a big sort of tactical blunder here, hasn't he? He was riding very hard in that group when he really didn't need to.
Well, I mean, what do you do there? You know, traditionally the yellow jersey is the guy who should be on the front, but you know, Nibali's in a position where he can defend.
You ride on the front, but you don't ride like that. I mean, I think we could see from the expression on his face, he was making a big effort. He made a big effort just to catch Valverde and Nibali. Then he went, more or less went straight to the front. He was making a, you could see he was making a big effort.
Would you prefer him just to kind of Gallic shrug, Rich?
But it's almost as though he was riding to distance the guys behind him rather than...
Which he surely was. I mean, I think he is very aware that he's not thinking of winning the Tour de France. It would be a fantastic result for him if he finished in the top five. He came into this tour wanting to finish between sort of fifth and eighth place. So if he manages to finish on the podium, that is a result beyond his wildest dreams.
Even better if he just not made quite such an effort there and then followed Nibali when he attacked.
Let's not be too harsh on him. I mean, this is the first time he's really been in this sort of position where he's got some tactical cards to play. The problem for all of those guys is the gap to Nibali before the start of today's stage was already 2.5+ minutes. So they're going to have to do something pretty fantastic. And really, they're relying on Nibali falling apart to a certain extent to close that gap. So you can see that Pino is trying to cement his place on the podium while he can. And he's got Bardet out the back at the moment. Bardet is chasing, having to do a lot of that work. And obviously, he's probably doing that work for his teammate Perrault. But Pino is moving into a strong position here if he can maintain it to the top.
Yeah, I mean, we were making the point today, Lionel, Nibali does look, you know, clearly the strongest rider in the race. Until today's stage, the most of his advantage was gained on the cobbled stage. You know, he only had 15 seconds on Thibaut Pinot on the only real sort of mountaintop finish at La Planche des Belles Filles the other day. You know, there wasn't much tangible evidence of his superiority on the climbs really until this today.
No, that's right. I mean, it was he gained almost 2 minutes on Richie Port and more on just about all the other climbers just on the cobbles. So that's where his advantage has been forged, certainly.
And just talking to a few coaches on other teams over the past few days, they have noticed, and we have noticed as well, that Nibali does attack very hard, but then he also plateaus quite soon after that. You know, within 100, 200 metres, he tends to open up a gap and then the gap tends to hold.
Well, let's just move in now and watch the closing few kilometres.
Well, we've just watched Nibali win his third stage of this tour, which is quite a tally of stage wins already, and he's taken 50 seconds there out of Valverde and Thibaut Pinot. Valverde jumped Pinot on the way up to the line, and that earned some disapproving tuts from various Frenchmen standing around me at the Garmin Sharp bus. But there's something about Valverde, isn't there, that people don't warm to?
Well, you could see that happening from a long way out. I mean, I'd like to know what Pino and Valverde were saying to each other as they went up the climb. Perhaps, Daniel, you'll be able to find out if you're going to the FDJ bus shortly. But that was about as predictable as you get on the Tour de France. Valverde was going to jump Pino at the end there just to put a few seconds between them. I thought Nibali was good. He's clearly the best climber in the race, but he didn't exactly leave Leopold Koenig and Rafael Majka for dead, did he? And they've been out there for a fair while on their...
It does illustrate what the point that Daniel made earlier. You know, his initial attacks look very impressive, but he doesn't sort of take off. He does plateau. He does sort of settle into a rhythm. Not that I can see him at this moment in time being beaten this tour, but, you know, there have to be questions about the strength of his team after today. And you know, he's been riding hard since stage two of this tour to maintain that sort of level of performance, that intensity of effort for 3 weeks is going to be tough, and surely he's going to have a hard day, a difficult day in the final week. Daniel, what do you think?
You thought he was riding within himself, the way he was climbing, perhaps he was riding a little bit within himself.
Yeah, I mean, there are two schools of thought, aren't there? There are people who say that you should count on a grand tour.
Mark Maddio
on his bike in a pair of jeans, stonewashed jeans. The people who say you should kind of count and measure every droplet of energy and never ever spend too much if you don't have to on a grand tour. Others, and I probably subscribe to this theory, that you should strike while the iron is hot. You're not going to be in absolutely top form for the whole 3 weeks. You're going to suffer some days. And Nibali obviously had it within him to take more time today, and he did that. And you know, those could be 40 valuable seconds come the end of the race.
Shane Sutton always used to say that you start a grand tour with a full tank of petrol, and it is about managing the distribution of the fuel over the course of 3 weeks. That's another school of thought, I suppose.
It's all starting to kick off here, chaps. Should we go our separate ways and reconvene?
Let's divide and conquer.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Okay, chaps, so we're back down at the press centre now, having been around the team buses, trying to speak to riders and directors. Just to wrap up the stage, a very impressive stage win for Nibali, of course. Looked very comfortable, but one thing, you mentioned this, Daniel, how he looked like he was riding within himself. The guy who wins often looks like that, doesn't he? Because he's the confidence that comes from having dropped everybody, riding to the win, is yeah, it's one of the most misleading things, I think, that often we see guys winning races looking fresh, and that can actually not be an accurate picture of how they're actually, what the effort is actually taking out of them, I think.
No, you're right. I mean, everyone gives, you know, to use the footballing cliche, everyone gives 100%, 110% in fact, not just 100%. What I suppose I meant by that is that Nibali never had to go really deep into the red, as deep into the red as, you know, we saw other guys trying to hold wheels and sort of in that kind of panic state that you get into when you see the guy above you on general classification disappearing up the road. You know, if Nibali had to go harder at any point, or at certain points, I think he probably could have.
Okay, so a great day for Vincenzo Nibali, a good day for Thibaut Pinot, a good day for Alejandro Valverde, a terrible day for Richie Porte and Team Sky. And I camped outside the Team Sky bus at the finish, and I spoke briefly to Dave Brails for the team principal and Richie Porte, who initially wasn't going to stop and speak, but he did stop briefly.
Obviously, it wasn't the Richie that we've seen for the first part of the race. And, you know, he's just got to rest and recover and try and go again tomorrow.
You see that coming, Dave, or with the same as wearing the costumes?
No, not really. To be honest, I think, you know, the first climbs and the efforts that have been made uphill have been good, to be honest. So, apart from, we knew it was going to get hot. I think that was, we were a bit concerned about that, obviously, and from the rest day, we knew that it was going to get hot. But I wouldn't, you know, that's the same for everybody. Yeah.
Is the heat something that Richie suffers?
No, I don't think so. I think, not particularly. I think it's the transition from cold to hot that can catch you out, you know, and that's what we've been a bit worried about, to be fair. And I think Geraint felt it as well today. But equally, listen, it's no excuse. You know, it's not trying to hide anything. It's not a great day, and you've got to hold your head up and get on with it. You know?
What would be Team Sky's ambitions in the Tour now, then?
Well, we're not just going to roll over. I think, obviously, it was a blow losing Chris. You know, when you think you're coming here to try and win the race. And certainly, having seen how Nibali's going, it would have been an interesting race, that's for sure. And then recalibrated to, you know, to our plan B, as it were. And now I've got to recalibrate again, but I think you just got to take stock of the situation, not get too downbeat. There's still a lot of racing to go, and try and get something out of the race, that's for sure.
It's one of those things. I think it's a massive shame, but we'll just see what happens tomorrow. Yeah, it's not the best either, but it's a shame. I think I feel more for my teammates who have been brilliant for me every day, but you know, if it happens to me, I think it can happen to other guys too. So, just keep on pushing.
So Richie Porte really collapsed today. His overall ambitions, I think, are over. And it's, as Dave Brailsford said, a case of recalibrating for Team Sky. That was plan B. They're down to plan C or plan D now, I guess. Plan G, Geraint Thomas. I know we're not supposed to use riders' nicknames, but Dave Brailsford spoke the other day actually about being slightly concerned about just how much Geraint Thomas was doing in this tour, and it perhaps caught up with him today because he didn't. I'm not sure we'd have expected him to stay in that front group, but he was dropped fairly early on, I think, on the climb. And you know, perhaps all those efforts that he's been making over the first sort of 10, 12, 11, 12 days of this tour caught up with him.
Yeah, well, a lot of those efforts have been as a result of falling on the floor, having to get back up and chase back on. And as we've said repeatedly over the podcast, that takes its toll. And, I suppose it's a case of what might have been for both Porte and Thomas, because they have this completely free hand to show what they can do in a three-week Grand Tour in the biggest and baddest of them all, the Tour de France. And we now won't really get an indication of whether they have that that kind of deep level of consistency that you need.
But perhaps we are. Perhaps that's what we are getting with Richie Porte in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say I told you so, but with Richie Porte, we've been talking about the his tendency to have a bad day since the start of the tour. Put that to Dave Brailsford in Mulhouse. He was quite almost defensive about it. He said that last year at the Stade de Bagnères de Bigorre, where Porte collapsed, there was a unique set of circumstances in the first hour of the race which made him go deep into the red, and that was why that had happened. But, you know, the general classification in major tours and someone's sort of CV in major tours doesn't lie, and Richie Porte's always had a bad day. And Geraint Thomas as well, you know, people say they see him at the front of races and they see him at the front on climbs, and they watch Paris-Nice and they say, oh, this guy's got the potential to be a major tour contender. But there is, he's light years away from that at the moment. I'm sorry, I mean, there is a million miles between being good in Paris-Nice and contending for the Tour de France.
Well, on that subject, Daniel, I think you had a chat with your doppelganger, Max Chiandri. Very strange, as I walked past the two of you, and it was like you were standing looking in a full-length mirror.
Yeah, there's the hair. I'm the kind of wannabe Anglo-Italian. He's the real Anglo-Italian. There's the, you know, the impressions. But yeah, I did. Started off with Max talking about TJ Van Garderen's performance. We both sort of agreed that it was a good, not great day for Van Garderen. Then we went on to talk about Richie Porte, and you'll hear here that Max really wanted to say more than he actually could about Richie Porte. He obviously has quite strong feelings about Richie Porte and how prone he is to bad days, but he managed to stay fairly discreet. So here he is talking about Van Garderen first and then Richie Porte.
Contact in, quiet, but we're really happy about it. You know, I think TJ did good. You know, he kind of went through a little bit of a moment being right behind him, and we haven't spoken him yet. He kind of hesitated a little bit. Then he got a good rhythm on the climb. He started opening gaps and started making time back. You know, we've got a good team around him at the end of the day. I mean, everybody was there at the bottom of the climb. Stenner stepped in really well today. Van Avermaet did a good job. So it's just staying quiet, tucked in. Go through tomorrow, rest day, then we got the last week and time trial. That's what we're looking at.
I mean, it kind of looks like between sort of fourth and seventh is my position at the moment. Do you feel that, or do you think he's maybe better than that?
Well, you know, we always hope for the best. We don't want to be too bouncing around, so if we just kind of keep a bit of a quiet happiness, we for sure look for pretty high up, because we are confident that TJ is on he's on a good moment. You know, he came, if you just have to look back a little bit, you know, he came out of Dauphiné on the good side, but he still needed some kilometres to be where he is up right now. I think we just with a good moment.
Did the Porte loss of that much time, did that surprise you?
Well, you know, I don't want to say, I mean, Richie's a great guy, and you know, as a could be a lot of talking. I could talk a lot about this, but we all know that Richie has one off day. You know, I think a lot of people know that, and I think today was his bad day. He put himself back into a try and winning stage. Maybe I don't think GC's gone for him big time. And I'll just stop here.
Without being specific about Richie, just generally when guys have a tendency to have those really bad days, is it more mental than physical, do you think? Is it some guys can really dig in and limit it to 3 or 4 minutes, whereas other guys just kind of
it could be a mental thing as well, because I mean, Cadel was one of them guys and he ended up winning a tour, you know, so, and Cadel always had a bad day, you know. He always is around I think it is a mental thing. I think you know, I don't know how you can cope with that, but you know, some guys got around it and just made a, you know, again, Cadel, can't think of any other guys really with bad days, but then can kind of win a big grand tour. But you knew kind of Richie he's going through that, and he wasn't a leader in this team, he was a sport leader, he's a great rider. But, you know, there you go.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So that was Max Chiandri, or Daniel Freiba's Max Chiandri, not really sure. We're going to get more of Daniel as Max Chiandri as this Tour de France goes on. Now, Lionel, you camped outside the the NetApp in Jura bus.
We should point out that he didn't literally camp. You know, you are booked into hotels every night. There's no tent in the back. No, of
that's a fair point. That's a fair point, Danny. I'm glad you pulled me up for that. He metaphorically camped outside the NetApp in Jura. Not even a bus, a camper van. A camper van. It was like an awning that you had there beside
it's
the...
Kind of visceral camping. Vicarious camping.
Vicarious camping.
Sorry.
Lionel, so you were waiting for your man, who you tipped at the start of this tour as the potential outsider, Leopold Koenig, who rode exceptionally well today. We know he's a decent rider from the Vuelta. I think the ambition, I spoke to Paul Voss yesterday, he said the ambition for Koenig was top 15 overall, but he's looking pretty good for maybe top 10.
Well, yeah, you say that. In one of the interviews he gave in English before I got to talk to him, he actually said that it was the team that set that ambition of top 15, and he's not putting a ceiling on it or indeed feeling pressure to live up to that necessarily. He doesn't want to think that the top 10 is out of reach, but nor does he want the pressure of having to live up to an overall performance. He just wanted to go out today. He said he was glad that he was with Micah, Rafael Micah of Tinkoff Saxo, because he's a strong climber, but he was fairly guarded in what he said about Micah's efforts. He felt he could have done a bit more, certainly in the middle part of the climb, and that Koenig felt he was doing the bulk of the work. But there was a real nice atmosphere outside the NetApp Enduro bus, because Koenig's mum was there, some other members of his family. They were all wearing NetApp Enduro jerseys, huge Czech flags, and I think, you know, he's going to be one of those riders that we'll look back on at the end of this tour and think that this was his breakthrough performance. I mean, finishing in the top 10 of the Vuelta is fantastic, but the Tour de France is another level altogether. Although, you know, you could argue that the level of competition he's up against is going to be almost Vuelta-esque, apart from Nibali. But I grabbed a few words from him as he warmed down on his turbo trainer. I'm waiting at the NetApp bus at the finish here in Chamrous, and I've just heard that the first 10 riders on the stage have been asked to go to doping control. I say asked, I mean forced to go to doping control. It's not optional. And Leopold Koenig of the NetApp team, who is one of the two riders out in front before Nibali caught them, he obviously finished in the top 10, so I may be in for a little bit of a wait here. Well, here comes Leopold Koenig now. He's just coming back to the NetApp bus, so I'm going to go in and try and get a quick word with him. Leo, you have your mum and some family and supporters here. How much did that give you extra motivation on the final climb there?
Yeah, it's quite nice feeling when you see all along the road all the Czech flags, because you can really see the flags. I don't see the people, but the flags, you know, it's quite amazing feeling. So I realize I had a lot of support, and I'm just grateful to them, because it's a really nice feeling.
How big is cycling in the Czech Republic at the moment?
It's quite big, because after every stage I'm getting like free interviews for the biggest magazine, newspapers and TV stations, so they care a lot. And I think the tour, the race, is a lot. It's a lot viewed even in a sport TV in the Czech, in the national Czech TV. So I believe it's quite popular and the people are enjoying.
Now, usually in the Tour de France, when the yellow jersey catches the breakaway on a final mountain, we expect the yellow jersey to go past and take a big gap. But you and Micah, particularly you, kept that gap very small. Did that encourage you a lot for the future mountain stages?
Of course, because I expect the same. That's why I didn't even try to follow Nibali. I just went my own pace, and in the end, I don't know exactly how many seconds, but I think maximum 20, and that's something which gave me extra confidence, because, like you said, I expected to get a gap like 1 minute, but finally the gap wasn't there, so I'm really happy.
Okay, well, we'll wrap this up in a moment or two. Just a reminder that you can find us on Twitter at @cycling_podcast, on Facebook, and like us there, win a pair of Oakleys. Not everybody who likes us wins a pair of Oakleys, but someone who likes us will win a pair of Oakleys. We're blogging every day on thecyclingpodcast.com. Daniel has written an excellent blog today analysing Peter Sagan's various near misses. And a competition that a listener suggested. We did a competition the other day to win a phone call from Jonathan Voters. We'll have one next week to win a phone call from Dan Martin, the Garmin Sharp rider. But in the meantime, we're going to offer a competition to win a phone call from Ciro Scognamiglio.
Oh, really?
Yeah, somebody said they'd like to win a phone call from Ciro. So we're going to organise that. Shouldn't be too difficult. He's up for that. There's a guy who looks like him there. Anyway, we'll arrange that. So again, tweet at cycling_podcast. Hashtag Ciro call, and tell us in your opinion why Ciro should speak to you, or why do you want to speak to Ciro? Even better, why do you want to speak to Ciro?
Just say Ciro is C-I-R-O, so hashtag
part of the
Ciro
part,
call
part of the test.
Like, oh really? Oh, sorry.
Let's open that up on Facebook as well. You can, if you're not on Twitter, you can leave Facebook messages as well. Facebook us and suggest why. That gives you a bit more space to explain why she would speak to you. Anything else, Daniel?
Can I set you guys a competition? Very quick competition. I want to know the name of the mountain massif that we are overlooking here. It's a beautiful view where we are. There's a little, well, it's actually a man-made lake just above the press room. And just through the trees there, there's a very...
Is it the Dolomites?
No, it's not.
Is it the Chartreuse?
Yes, it is, Lionel.
It looks like the Dolomites to me.
It's the Chartreuse Massif, which...
Daniel, there's a Movistar bus coming down the hill towards us. Hopefully it's going to break. You spoke to the Movistar at the end.
Yeah, I spoke to Eusebio Unzue, who is the team manager of Movistar. He feels that Nibali is probably unbeatable, but I mentioned the stage in the Pyrenees last year to Bagnères de Bigorre, where Movistar lit it up and sort of... Well, I never really got Chris Froome on the ropes, but perhaps could have done if they'd played their cards slightly differently. Asked Unzue whether that was something they might try again. He didn't rule it out, but he was fairly pessimistic. On the other hand, he did say that, you know, with the weather really heating up today, Valverde had felt good, and if the weather continues in this vein, then it will be very much in Valverde's favour.
No, you don't speak... So I think Spanish is possibly the only language you don't speak, Daniel.
I understand Spanish.
Were you speaking French to him? Or?
No, we get by in a kind of pastiche of French and Spanish.
Okay, great. Well, let's wrap up there. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, both.
Interviews and analysis. We've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.